Okay, welcome to Extroverted Developer, a new podcast about computer programming and technology in New York City. I'm Jim Wallace.
And I'm Ben Gunderson.
And today we have a special guest here, Santos Cordon.
Hi. Hello, everybody.
Santos, all right, let's get some background on you. Let's talk about how you became a computer programmer.
I guess I always enjoyed it.
Yeah?
I think the first time I, like, wrote a program that was... Well, it actually goes further back than that. I had a... My dad brought a computer home. I must have been in junior high at the time. You know, I'd seen computers at school, and I've played games with them at school. But I think the first one we got home, it must have been either in sixth grade or in middle school, and I broke it. Like, I just kept breaking it. Because I tried doing different things that I thought would work. And
so this must have been a Windows DOS computer.
Oh, yeah. It was Windows 3.1. Or 3.0, I forget. And I just, you know, I kept getting in trouble, and I didn't want to get in trouble anymore. So I started learning more about the computer before I did the stuff that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'd go, and I wanted a better a video card, so I went, you know, I saved up some money, got a better video card, stuff like that. And then, you know, in high school, I think I used my sister's TI calculator, and, you know, you play with the TI basic calculator.
Yeah.
And then the internet started sort of becoming really good place to actually do stuff at that time. So I went on there and I started looking for...
So this is like 98?
No, this was probably 96, I want to say.
96, okay.
Yeah, and then I went on there and I, you know, started reading about these programs that people were writing. You know, I wrote programs to help me in chemistry class, little racer programs and stuff like
especially
that.
Especially on the calculators. Yeah. I wrote a lot of math programs because they make a lot of mistakes.
Yeah. You know, so everyone... The funny thing about those calculators is you write these programs to help you in classes like chemistry or whatever. Like I remember, I forget what it's called, but when you had to draw the electron dots around sort of...
balance the valence electrons.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and then you had to like remember which ring they were in. So I wrote an app that would just like, you know, punch in whatever
the
whatever
atomic
it was.
Weight was, and
well, I think just the element, and it would like print it up and like draw it out. And
nice.
The funny thing about that is now I could use it in chemistry, but I did so much work getting it to work that it was just faster for me to calculate it in my head by that point. And then I read about people compiling programs for the TI calculator. So
originally they were BASIC, which is an interpreted language.
Yeah,
okay.
So you could compile them into native language.
Assembly.
Yeah, assembly. And then I think you actually may have... You had to write it in assembly.
Right.
And
most
it.
I knew were they wrote in assembly straight.
I did not know what that meant.
Yeah, neither did I.
So I just avoided that.
Yeah, so did I.
So that's sort of where I got started. Then, you know, I built a website, started doing JavaScript, a little PHP... CGI, Ben, crap.
This is like PHP 2 or PHP 3, right? Like
and then,
way back.
Yeah, and then I went to college and continued.
Nice. Yeah. And then, so what's your degree in?
Computer science.
Computer science degree, okay. And then after that, you wound up at Microsoft.
Yeah, I did. It's actually funny. I got, they came to my school and, you know, they made you write, you gave them your resume. Then you take the back of the resume, and then they ask you a programming question, like, on the spot. It was, like, job fair outside. And so I don't remember the question. They asked me something, you know.
What's the difference between a class and a
string? No, it was a program. I had to write, like, solve something or reverse a string, something like that. Something, you know, that you don't actually ask in a real interview, but easy enough to do in the back of your resume. And then I never heard back from them. And, like, maybe a month later, I looked at my resume, and I noticed it was an old email address that I had used.
Oh, oops.
And it wasn't even working anymore. So I signed up for it again. I had no less than like 2 hours later, I got the, hey, just so you know, sort of trying to reach you last time for this interview. And I said, oh, you know, you caught me. I'm sorry. It was a bad email and all that stuff. And then we missed each other again because I was out of town. Eventually, it just did, instead of an on-site interview at my school, we did a phone interview.
Mm-hmm.
And then I flew out to Redmond for the on-site interview, and I actually didn't think I would get the job. I wasn't very confident, and I think that helped me more than anything.
Yeah, because you're like, oh, if it's a free trip to Seattle, you know, like at least I got to go to Seattle.
Absolutely, and that's how I treated it. Like, you know, it's great, and I'll do my best in this interview, but I'm not keeping my hopes up.
By the way, exact same story, yeah. except for I got the email. I used a good email address.
And then I go up there and I had my interview and I was so just comfortable that I just sort of went through it. And by the fifth interview, I thought, you know, maybe I'm doing well. Like everything seems to be going well. Nothing's really
like I'm answering all the questions.
Yeah.
Like
I don't feel tied up. And the moment I started thinking that, that interview went terrible.
The last one?
No, the fifth one. Right. The last one was it's probably the scariest interview that I had. I'd say the scariest interview questions only because of how they asked. Mm-hmm. So the question that they asked me, the last one, first he drew up some very obscure binary operator kind of C++ code, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much just C code. And you couldn't really tell what it did. And so the first question was, okay, what does this code do? And so I took, I took a little bit and I took some time and I gave him an answer. I forget what it did, but I gave him an answer. He says, okay, are you sure that's what it does? And in a way that, you know, questioned whether
what I do. Like, no.
And he says, let me take another look. And then I take another look and I say, yes, that's what it does. And he says, are you 100% sure that's what it does? And then, you know, I'm like, well, let me take another look. Because all you want to do is you want to find one bug. And
right, one problem.
One problem with the code and you're set. But I couldn't. And, you know, eventually I'm like, look, I'm taking additional 3-4 minutes here every time he asks me. I just have to be confident. I say, okay, I'm 100% sure this is what it does. And then he says, are you willing to risk your getting this job or not on the fact that this code works? And then just like my stomach fell on my feet and I was like, I guess I'm doing well, but I'm not going to do well after this. And I couldn't find it. And I told him that. I said, look, I can't find a problem. This seems to, you know, do what I did, do what it says, or rather what I said. And, you know, I followed test cases. I put test cases up. I did corner cases.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. And everything seemed to work out. And, it, you know, it's important in those interviews, I've found out now, to actually write out the test cases and, you know, walk through the code with them. And I said, yes, this works. And then in the end, he says, yep, it works. Okay. And I got a call back the next day. So it was Friday, and I think Monday morning they called me back. They said they were going to give me an offer.
Hmm.
So.
Oh, that was full-time. You didn't do an internship first?
No, I didn't do an internship. Okay. No.
Cool. And while you were there, you worked on Microsoft Office.
I did. For
four Can you
years.
Talk a little bit about the stuff you did there? Whatever is available to talk
sure.
about.
Sure. I worked on a team in Office called Longhorn Platform Team. And what that team was supposed to do is create light up features for Office in Vista.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things, make sure we utilize Vista's new APIs for doing, you know, whatever new things that Vista did. Problem is, it was taking so long, Vista.
Yeah.
It
got reset halfway through and took place as long.
So the team started taking on different projects, random projects from other teams. So this Office is broken up into sort of the main teams like Word, Outlook, Excel, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's shared services team. So mine was under the shared services. And
is Line Services a part of that?
I don't know what that is.
Okay.
Yeah. And so shared services writes code that's shared amongst all the apps. So they'll write code for the ribbon, for example.
Okay.
That's something that was being worked on while I was there. I took on a project, OneNote Mobile. So they wanted to write a mobile app that would work on Windows mobile phones at the time. This was 2005.
Okay, so it was called Windows Mobile. It wasn't CE anymore.
Yeah, it was Windows Mobile Phone and Pocket PC. They were,
Pocket PC,
they were,
that's
they
right.
They were two different products at that point.
The Compaq and the Dell Axon.
Yeah.
Had both of those.
and so I wrote I worked on that for a while. And then eventually we shipped Outlook. I'm sorry, shipped Office 2007, that was. And then that, because it was an Office 2017, we sort of it disbanded and we transitioned to other teams.
Okay.
Then I went to a trustworthy computing team and I helped Vlad, who was sort of the primary developer, work on the new thread pool for Office 2010. And then and that's what I did there.
Cool.
Yeah.
And you came to New York City to follow a girl.
I did.
Which I think is very romantic.
My wife now, so I met her in 2005, New Year's 2005, while I lived in Seattle and she lived in New York City. Then, you know, things led to other things, and we did a long distance relationship for a couple of years, and we played the I'm Not Moving For You game for a while. And then she got into med school here in New York, so, you know, she wasn't leaving for 4 years, so I decided
to come to New York.
And I left Microsoft. I decided I'd been there long enough.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it there. I really enjoyed it there, but I thought, you know, since I'm moving, I might as well try something new.
Okay.
And so I tried finance. I didn't like it.
Fair enough. I also tried finance. Yeah. Santos and I worked at LiquidNet together. Mm-hmm. I also didn't like it.
Yeah, it's just the thing that I didn't like and about finance and what I found out I really love is being able to use the software that I write. So I don't like writing, you know, software for salespeople that
where you're not
care.
A salesperson.
Yeah,
you don't.
There's you're never gonna have the insight that you'll have if you use your own software.
That's right. And working on Microsoft Office, you're like, I can see this problem in Outlook. I see it every day, and I want it to be better.
Right.
Absolutely.
Freelancers complain about that as well because you're constantly giving away your product at the end of the day to the client, you know, and then you never see it again, and you're never really going to be the end user of it. Write an app for someone. And
I mean, it depends on what you freelance too, but generally, projects that will pay freelancers are not projects for applications.
Right, they're internal software for, I don't know, actuaries or something boring like that.
But it comes down to writing something for yourself or writing it for other people.
Right. And I think there's lots of things to say about software quality, right? There's lots of methods for finding bugs. Some are better and broader than others. But as an individual developer, I think there's nothing better for quality of software than actually using it.
Yep.
Like using it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't have a whole team of people and a large beta test audience and things like that. The other ways to find software flaws. And yeah, no, that's a great point. Like leaving finance, because we'll never use that. We'll never be traders. We don't have a Series 7. And when there's a problem, we don't care.
That's the other thing about, I just was not interested in the finance world at all. So you said Series 7. Probably should know what that is. Don't.
It's a thing that allows you to be a trader.
Yeah.
It's like, it gives you fiduciary responsibility to your clients, not to the firm.
I see.
And you have to pay, like, it's a licensing, a certification, sort of like a doctor can lose their license. You can lose your Series 7 as a broker if you've acted dishonestly, for example.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's just a licensing thing.
One of the things that just does not interest me, unfortunately. I wish it did. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made in finance. So if I found it interesting, I'm sure I could do well there, but I don't find it interesting. So I actually don't think I'll ever do well because I don't find it interesting.
Yeah, and I could tell that you were not happy. So I was ready for a change. And then you went to another New York company.
I did. Well, company in New York. I went to Google.
A company in New York. You went to Google.
Went to Google, yeah. I actually interviewed with Google when I first came to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they're... it took so long to sort of get that process to go through, and the company that I ended up going to, they're giving me, telling me, hey, we need an answer within a couple weeks, and sort of the Google thing was taking a while. I think my recruiter may have gone on vacation or something.
Yeah, sure. The Google process notoriously takes a long time to make a decision. I've read horror stories on the internet where people are like 3 months go by and they hear nothing from Google. So yeah, common story.
Yeah. So then, so when I was thinking about, you know, leaving LiquidNet, Google contacted me again, asked me if I wanted to continue sort of the interview process, and I said yes, and went there and got a job, and I've been there 2 years now.
Yay. Yeah. And you like that much better, working for a software company?
Google's the best company I've worked for.
Yeah.
I think I'm happiest at Google. Microsoft was fun too. I'd say it's second best company to work that I've worked for,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of that is sort of people too, and you know, make sure you meet the right people, and
and the quality of engineering,
I thought the quality of engineering at Microsoft was great, like
I would say that they're both high quality engineering.
Yeah.
I couldn't say that one is better than the other, honestly, by my experiences.
And for the majority, like my experience at LiquidNet was they were high quality engineering too, pretty much, right? Like,
yeah.
Different skill sets, different backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
you know, but they cared about continuous integration and making sure their software didn't have flaws. But that thing about not being able to use your own software is really, the killer.
I didn't like that part.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you for giving us that background and stuff. We've got a couple topics that we'd like to discuss with you today. So let's talk about hiring quality engineers.
Yeah, I was interested in the bit about the interview process at Microsoft. I'm actually interested in how the interview at Liquidnet went. What did, I mean, did you come out of that? It seems like you came out of the in Microsoft interview with like a certain amount of like respect
For the process,
For the confidence they require.
Yeah, that was a cool answer, like, or a cool story about, like, is that your final answer? You have to have very much confidence. Like,
was Liquidnet the same way? Like, in what way is the world of finance interview differently than the world of tech?
Well, I've done several interviews in finance. So when I was looking to leave Liquidnet, I did a couple more interviews with different banks. And
banks and hedge funds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's really similar. I think by that point, I'd worked for long enough that I felt like I was interviewing the company as much as they were interviewing me. And I think there's a level of confidence that goes a long way getting through interviews. But in terms of questions, smaller companies tend to be less standardized about sort of the processes and everything, processes.
You mean the interview processes?
Yeah. So it really depends, I think, on smaller companies who interviews you. And so that's basically what I felt at Liquidnet. I felt like, it wasn't like a give me answer.
Right. So
it wasn't a give me interview. It was a little bit easier technically.
But they make you write code.
They make you write code and do all that.
So when you and I were interviewing at Microsoft, it was probably a 70,000 person company, which is humongous.
Yeah.
And they've got their process pretty much down.
Right. Yeah.
Liquidnet, in contrast, was a 400, I think, person company, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. And then when you interviewed at Google, they were almost 20,000, I think, at that time. So the difference in the process and methodology is definitely apparent.
Right.
That said, I think Liquidnet's actually the company that asked me a question. The only interview in which I was asked a question where I just felt like I could not figure out the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that because they went out and looked up a really hard question?
No, I think it was when I got hired, I talked to the person interviewing me, and it's just a question that they found interesting. I think it was an Othello-type question.
This is Yevgeny's question Lights Out.
Yeah, Lights Out, that's what it was.
Lights Out.
And really, in retrospect, it was, I should have figured it out. I think.
For that one, I came up with a solution, which was just an exhaustive search.
Yeah.
Death first exhaustive search. And
well, what's the Othello, like the board game?
It's not Othello. It's Lights Out. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you've got a pattern on here, and the point of the game is to push buttons such that all the lights are off at the end. That's how you win.
Okay.
But when you push a button, the adjacent buttons light up, or they toggle from on or off.
Right.
So when you push a light, it goes off, but the four around it turn on.
Okay.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's like there's a solution. Like right. you can solve this game.
There's a brute force solution, and then
An
elegance. Well, there's I think the question that I was asked revolved around figuring out sort of how many possible scenarios there were,
and you're supposed to
realize that. I mean, the realization of a question like that is that on and off, it's basically it's binary. If you turn a light on and you turn a light off, it puts it into the exact same state it was before. So you'll never have to push a light on twice, generally, I think. I don't know. It's hard to say.
But right, you'll always move.
My mistake.
Right, you'll never hit
so
that.
In the game, if you click a dark light, it turns on, and the ones around it all turn off.
Yeah.
So all the ones, or so the four around it, just switch.
Yeah,
just
toggle,
switch,
yeah.
Right? So if they're different patterns of on and off, they will switch their state around it.
Okay.
And there's like a mathematical proof that shows that you can solve this without ever hitting a button twice. But I don't know anybody who's really familiar with that.
Well, it's an interesting question, and you don't really generally have to know the answers to interview
to
do well. My problem, and it was my fault, was that I assumed that there was a really efficient solution for what I was working on.
Mm-hmm. There's a linear solution to that.
Whatever the question it was in the end, I actually talked to Yevgeny about it. The question in particular he asked me was not linear.
Oh, okay.
But I was trying to find a linear solution to it, and I rat-holed myself. So I would not think, I could not get myself to think broader and think.
Yep. Give me a solution first.
And that's what I should have done.
Right,
and that's something good to remember in an interview. Give a solution, then improve your solution. right. You know, depending on the kind of time that you have. And so since
yeah,
I didn't
great
do
advice
that,
to programmers.
Right. Well, that's the kind of the standard.
Give the n
advice,
squared solution, right, and yeah, say, hey, I know there's a better one, but this will solve
it. Make
it
work, then refactor.
Right.
Yeah, generally, and it's usually just a when those questions, if there's like an n squared solution and an n log n solution, I generally will start with, if there's an easy n squared solution, I'll do this, and this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, spend like two sentences and then go to the next thing. Just so that it starts off with an answer, a positive answer, sort of before you move on to anything else.
Do you now in your current role interview other people? That's a big part of being a writer, is you're supposed to sit in on interviews and
So actually I'm right now I'm going through sort of the training process. People when you get hired, you can generally start that training process. I waited a little while. But you do these interviews and interview people, so yes.
Right.
Do you have any opinion on what is an effective way to, like, you've been through many types of interviews, mm-hmm, by many companies, by software companies, and you've worked at a lot of places. Do you have an opinion about which interviews yielded the highest quality engineers?
I think it's actually, I guess it's a little bit about process. The trick I would do, well, if I was going to recommend how
to... Let's say you started a company and you're trying to hire engineers.
The first thing that I would do is I would make sure that they are, in importance, they are competent enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just takes a couple questions. And then, do I want to work with them?
Okay.
That's a big deal. And then, you know, how competent are they? So if you have the smartest people, I've worked with incredibly smart people that I don't want to work with.
Sure, absolutely.
And that person like that can kill a team, even if they're, you know, the smartest person in the world. And that's a problem. Because in a situation like that, yes, you may gain their productivity, but you lose everybody else's.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so it's a net loss. It hurts morale, nobody's happy.
Companies,
when people are happy, people work less. So I would ask technical questions. I would actually not ask brain teasers. That's the one thing I wouldn't do.
Sure.
They're interesting.
Wireman,
that's a classic thing. But there's a lot more about that.
Estimate the number of gas stations in the world.
Right.
Well, there's a bunch of things that you can read. There's not a lot of riddles I'm solving at work most of the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be great at riddles to be a great developer.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, occasionally throwing something in. The riddles, if there are any, should be built into a good question, right?
Right.
The riddle should be, what's the best way to design something, right?
Right.
And so I think if you're going to interview a candidate, it's good to give them a breadth of questions. Give them something, you know, technically difficult in a programming way. Give them a design question, because that's very important. If you can't design the software, if you can't design a big system, you can't design a little system. It's all the same. It's just scale. Most of the time.
So for the competent, are they competent enough? You would do that as a phone screen, or would you bring them in?
Yeah, that sounds like a phone screen. Right?
A phone screen thing.
Make sure they're competent enough, and then when they come in the interview, then you really measure the competency of the person. And, you know, if they meet your bars or whatever.
Do you think that programmers... So our audience, I think, is a lot of self-trained programmers, mm-hmm, and they didn't have algorithms and data structures. And so I'm curious if you think there can be competent programmers without having taken algorithms and data structures.
Taken it as a course?
Right. So a lot of these...
Or read a book or...
Well, a lot of the programming interview questions that I've had at, you know, Microsoft and Google and whatnot are... intensely algorithms and data structures questions, more so than they are problem solving questions.
If I'm interviewing somebody even at Google,
yeah,
and I ask them, you know, can you write the implementation of a red black tree?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, I don't know the implementation of a red black tree. In fact, I don't know what a red black tree is.
Okay.
I wouldn't put it against them, not a bit.
Okay.
I would tell them what it is.
And then see if they can,
you know, develop it. If you've been a programmer and you program, you've had to write data structures. So,
sure. In
terms of taking a class or not, you don't. The thing that you will lack is probably the naming conventions.
Sure, not the problem solving ability.
You shouldn't something like a linked list or even a doubly linked list, or which are very easy stuff that shouldn't phase you at all. If things like that phase you, probably not competent enough.
A lot of those things, programmers have solved the problem on their own.
Yeah, that's,
you know, they eventually came up with their own solution. Granted, you might not have come up with the idea for an R-star tree by yourself, but you probably figured out linked lists by yourself, even if you never learned what it was.
Yep, I agree. So that's, you don't need to take a course. Obviously, there's a lot of self-made people that are very successful. So I think the reading books helps. It helps get a language. Like, for example, design patterns. I read design patterns. It was recommended read when you get hired at Microsoft. And I thought it was very interesting. There's some stuff that... some stuff that I hadn't seen, most of the stuff I had, I just never put a name to it.
Right, because to you, it was just good object-oriented design.
Yeah, I mean, I did have an internship.
Mm-hmm.
And this is... I interned for DNA Group. They create FPGA hardware.
FPGA stands for Field Programmable Gate Array for our listeners.
Very good. I worked there. I did not know that. I mean, I did know it when I took the test for that class, for the hardware class. But I wrote... And they had me write software, and I really didn't know what I was doing. I knew what I was doing.
You had just taken a couple classes.
That internship basically opened the door for everything, because they let me just stay in front of a computer, write the program that they asked me to write, and then I would write it, and then I'd get about 90% of the way, and I'd look at my program, and I'd say, this program's terrible. Let me rewrite it.
Sure.
And the funny thing is, I did not know about STL or anything like that. I really just didn't have the experience. Maybe I should have. I was sophomore in college, junior in college.
No, they don't teach STL.
Yeah, you don't teach a lot of that in school. So I was writing my own data structures for this class. I wrote, linked lists, arrays, hashes, all this stuff. And I got 80, 90% of the way through again. And I said, this program's terrible. And so as you program, you start learning things that, this would have been better if I did it this way, And so they shouldn't have let me do this. I mean, I wasted a lot of time. But I rewrote that program like 4 or 5 times. And finally, I was super happy with it. And, good use of interfaces, good data structures, and all that stuff. And you read through books like Design Patterns, and you sort of see a lot of that stuff, and you put names to it.
Right. They just gave a label to something that you had thought really hard about. So you came up with Design Patterns from first principles, almost.
I mean, not all
exactly.
The basic design patterns.
Well, what you needed.
Yeah. And that's why. So I read that book, and I had mixed feelings about Design Patterns book, only because I also worked with people that I thought used it as a crutch. So
right.
They never really
think about every single thing.
They never
design.
Understood the data patterns really. I mean, they understand them only in that they can use them because the book told them to use them. They don't really understand why they work like. What's the best place to use them? And I've seen people use
design
patterns.
They use them as a shortcut for thinking.
Well, that's the thing. Oftentimes, they'll use them because they think they need to. And there's certain situations that I've seen code that could have been written in 10 lines, and they're using an entire, enormous pattern, requires like 3
Right, just
files.
In case someday someone wants to change a variable.
It's not even that.
It's probably not going to change.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right, it decouples things, which is nice. It allows you a lot of flexibility in things that you can change without having to rewrite a lot of code. But oftentimes I found in software, you don't rewrite them. They work.
if you really read the design patterns, the good design pattern books carefully, they'll say this is to help you. This is not, you're not supposed to use this like all the time. Be smart about how you're going to use this.
Right. Okay, so it sounds like basically you need to ask technical questions in a
interview. So the conversation that we were having before, the point, so to bring it back to the interview point, it's important for me that you can understand how to use data structures. Once they're explained to you and you sort of understand, and it doesn't take a long time for you to understand why they would be helpful in a certain situation and why not.
Mm-hmm.
Another way to phrase that is very simple questions of, what would you use? What data structure would you use for, sorting a dictionary kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
A good answer to that is it depends what you're going to use the dictionary for.
right? Are you going to look up the words, or are you going to try and find something in the definition?
Yeah, it depends on how you're going to use it. you know, do the words need to be sorted? Are you going to be showing things around there? And what is sort of the platform you're using it on? Those questions are important. So not necessarily an interview. Usually they'll give you a very basic, basic sort of scenario. Say, you know, on a super powerful computer where you have unlimited memory.
Yay!
Solve this question. So questions like that allow me to understand that you understand sort of where the limitations are and the use and the purpose of the data structures that you're using.
Okay. I guess let's move on to our next topic, which is you've been to a lot of places where they've written shrink wrap software. And now you work at some place that does software as a service, where you're continuously deploying. I'm wondering if you can help compare and contrast the different work environments, the different types of software lifecycle that go into them, what works best for one and what works best for the other, or just best practices. So like the idea is you've gone out, you've learned all these things, you've been to Microsoft, LiquidNet, and Google. You're now going to venture off and start your own company. Let's say it's a service company, because most places don't write shrink wrap software these days. I don't think. Anyway, new company starting up. What sort of best practices do you think you could take, without divulging any secrets, for your new company to help ensure the quality of software?
Again, the answer to that depends on what I'm building, right?
Okay.
Because if I'm building a game, then it is very much like shrink wrap software.
Right? Oh, great point. Yeah.
But if I'm building some internet service, it's probably continuous integration sort of stuff.
Okay.
I would, if it were me, I would use things as they are needed.
Right? Okay.
So, for example, all this continuous integration and all that other stuff, as needed. If it's me working on this
by yourself,
by myself, I'm probably not going to. And I'm trying to get this software out. I'm probably not going to care a lot about continuous integration. Is continuous integration to me is pushing the button that says run the tests.
Right.
And that's, so yeah, I don't need an automated system to push that button.
When you're working by yourself. Okay. Yep. Makes sense.
And probably not for smaller amounts of people. Sort of as you grow, I think that's the best time to integrate each of these things. I was actually just thinking about my experience the other day between writing services and shrink wrap software. So I'm actually moving to California soon, and I'll be transitioning to
closer to a shrink wrap model.
To Android team. So that'll be it's much closer to the shrink wrap model because right. You have dates.
Right, you have a release schedule. Yep. So at Microsoft, famously, everything takes 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But at Google, you are releasing every day.
Well, it depends on the team.
Sure.
Some people have like a month schedule. Some groups release every day. And the interesting thing about, the interesting difference that I noted about shrink wrap software and sort of the everyday thing is I feel personally, and this is just me, I feel like I have more pressure, I guess, to make sure I finish things quickly when it's a shrink wrap software case.
Oh, interesting.
And that's just me personally, because if you don't hit that, then a big date is
right. You slip a date. You're losing a big date,
right?
Millions of dollars.
But in the model where I can deploy every day, there's a little bit less pressure because I didn't finish it today. I'll finish it tomorrow.
And you're making much more incremental improvements on the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that.
So I think the answer to that is it really depends on the person.
Okay.
And I think in the end, which one's better? It depends on the person and really depends on what you're building to.
Okay, so I'm trying to get a scenario where you go to, let's say, a 20-person team, a startup. They're working on software as a service. They're working, they're creating services. Potentially, they could deploy every day. They have nothing. They've got no processes whatsoever. They've just got cowboy coders, but they have ramped up, and now they're 20 people.
Okay.
What types of things would you recommend? I mean, source control.
So that sure. what you just described. Well, source. I mean, there's a couple stuff that I just
you would use. No I, matter
yeah,
what.
Like it was there's individual. Just it's pointless to talk about a company that doesn't use them. I think. Source control, it's just, you have to do it.
Distributed or server-based?
Well, I just so long as you have source control.
Fair enough.
Right?
Fair enough.
You're talking about 20 people. I don't, you know, if they're around the world, then yeah, it's probably good to have
distributed source system.
It's like a company, you have to make backups. You make backups, you test your backups, right? If you don't do that, then you can't.
If I'm a 20-person company, I mean, I'm not going to keep my own server. I think that's silly. I think nowadays there's so many good services now, including, you know, software stuff like that. I just wouldn't want to maintain it. I can use a service that somebody else will maintain as long as they have some sort of guaranteed uptime, so I don't lose, you know, my developers when something happens. But that's a risk you take even with your own server, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The power supply fails, and now you don't have a server until the power supply comes.
And so I would opt for those services. Obviously, some companies can't do that. If the finance industry, for example,
I think it's
so
scared, finance.
So frightened of losing, you know, some software or whatever. I'm sure big companies are too.
Oh, the defense, like the government contractors, probably can't as well.
Yeah. Then there's like, yeah, absolutely. They won't use.
Sure, there's legitimate reasons to own the whole thing.
But if you don't have to, I wouldn't. You know, I mean, if I'm managing a company that's 5,000 people, then yeah, probably start, you know, or maybe even less. I've never done that, so this is all anecdotal, but I would probably move it in-house just so...
By yourself, are you running unit tests?
Funny thing about testing.
Okay.
And running unit tests is there's one problem that all these things don't address. Test-driven development, and I've done that.
Sure.
And it works. The greatest thing about test-driven development is that it forces me to use my APIs and interfaces in a slightly different way than I do in my program.
As if you're the consumer?
No, like, for example, in my program, I might, as I'm writing code, create some functions in an interface and then call them. And then when I go to test this code, I realize this isn't really testable the way I wrote this interface.
Okay.
So I got to rewrite it so it's usable in my test and my software. Never done that and not come up with a better interface. I've never felt like I didn't.
So test-driven development for you isn't just about quality assurance; it's also about design.
Oh, absolutely. In design, in that case, maintenance, right?
Yeah.
When stuff is better, you can maintain it better. But I've never met a person that likes writing tests. And that's what nobody addresses. Yeah. maybe test-driven development, you write the test first. I try that a little bit. It's hard. It's like writing... Especially writing your tests first is no different than writing your software first. You're using these things in a way that may not work all the time. So I think I'll write my software first, I'll write the test, and then, you know, I won't write the test... And I'm very careful, and I try really hard not to sort of mangle the test so that the thing is testable. Make sure that I'll change the interface so that it makes writing the test easy.
Refactor your code once it's working. You'll then write the test, mm-hmm. and if you find that you can't test it well, you'll refactor then to make sure that you can write the test.
Yeah, and so I actually dislike test-driven development, not because of the advantages, but because the disadvantage of I don't feel like I'm getting anything done if I'm just writing tests first. And that's just, it's a personal emotion. I don't feel like I'm getting anything done if I'm writing the test first. And so I'll write the code and I'll write the tests angrily because I have to write tests. And
that's enforced on you at Google.
Yeah.
You might not do that by yourself.
Oh, no, yeah. Like, I mean, a Java annotation file you're not going to write tests for. There's no test to write, really.
Mm-hmm.
But you're actually sometimes it might, but yeah, I mean, if you have testable code, you test your code.
Yeah, I've learned a lot about how to write testable mm-hmm. code, but I still don't do test-driven development, because oftentimes I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know JavaScript, or I don't know this new framework that I'm using mm-hmm. to write this. Like, let's say we're using Ruby on Rails, let's not say that because I don't know anything about Ruby on Rails. Let's say I'm using ASP MVC, right? I know nothing about how this framework works. I'm trying to learn ASP MVC and I'm trying to write software while I'm doing it. Writing the test first, I don't even know where to begin because I don't know any of the conventions of the framework. I don't know what entry points there are in the framework to test. And that's why I've always stumbled with writing unit tests. Because nobody writes everything from scratch these days. They all use some sort of model view. Maybe not at Google, but I mean, normal people writing startups, they're using Ruby on Rails, or they're using a MVC framework of some sort, Symfony on PHP,
right.
You know,
JavaScript using jQuery.
So this,
yeah. Right.
This may be, so I have an answer to that, and, okay. And it may be because I've worked at, you know, large companies that have quality code, mm-hmm. Generally, and sort of those the code that I'm interfacing with is generally also owned by that same company. So my assumption in there is if I'm using some framework, I'm going to assume that that framework is tested and has unit tests of its own.
Okay.
What I try to do in my tests is avoid doing anything that would also test their framework.
Right. You trust that Microsoft wrote data binding correctly if you're working at Microsoft.
And I make sure that my unit tests are working for and testing sort of my code. I don't sort of venture beyond it. And another good thing to do is there's been times in my life where I might make a test public just to make it testable, or a function public just so I can test that function specifically. I'm actually, lately, in the last couple of years, I've tried to make sure that I'm only testing the public interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't test all the code using only the public functions, the functions that are meant to be public in my
right.
interface, then it's probably because my, you know, my class or API has a side effect of something else, and generally that's a sign of bad design.
Okay,
So
this has helped you become a better software designer by being forced to write unit tests at Google.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it... Yeah, I guess it has. I was going to say, I don't know if it made me a better designer from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, by the end, there's a better design. But that's untrue. So you learn lessons from all this stuff. And I know that I've written interfaces and code before where I'm thinking about the testability of that code.
Okay. Oh, okay. I guess we'll end with... you work on the Google Docs team at
mm-hmm.
Google. And I was wondering if there were any features of Google Docs that you think are... underutilized or not well known?
Pro tip from a docs developer.
Pro tip. Yeah.
So, no.
No. Okay.
I don't know that. I don't know the answer. I work on Sites team and I don't really.
I think Sites itself is sort of an unknown
cool.
part
yeah.
of Google Docs.
Underutilized for sure.
Yeah.
It depends on what, but that's getting into sort of usage numbers that I can't really
talk
about.
No. I don't want you to reveal.
So, I'm a light docs user, meaning that I don't write intricate documents.
Mm-hmm.
I write design docs primarily. I consume a lot of, you know, specs and whatnot, but, I never really need to use a lot of the complex stuff. Spreadsheets, yeah. What I do with spreadsheets, I use it to do my budget at home.
Yep,
I use
same.
It to. We actually use it internally sometimes. We've created scripts to manage our builds and stuff like that, using sort of app scripts and spreadsheets. And it's always nice to do that, and I always try to do that. You want to. Eat your own dog food, right? You want to make sure you use
make
your
sure
own
you're
software.
Using it.
And that's the best way to, like we talked about earlier, it's the best way to make your product better is to make sure you use it. But I'm not an actuary, right? I don't
right,
need complex. I don't need complex functions generally to do the stuff that I'm doing. And my documents are never super intricate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll use word count if I'm writing something that needs word count. I'll use all that
sure.
stuff.
I said this to you in an email before, but I'll say it here on the podcast too, that I didn't really get Google Docs. I was like, why not just use Microsoft Office? Until recently, I've been using Google Docs to edit the podcast and to work with Ben collaboratively. And then I had an idea for a story, and I started writing out a story. It just opened up a Google document. And I had a friend of mine who fancies herself a writer, Jennifer, episode one, or
right.
episode two.
Yeah, she's in.
And she was able to log in. And as I'm typing out my story, she was editing it in real time, the part that I had already written.
That sounds so annoying.
And that it was actually awesome because it was like having a tester.
Yeah.
Like I can write software without having to like test, and they're testing my software as I write it.
Yeah.
It was the same thing because I was no longer worried, like, is the comma in the right place? Oh, so I was writing as fast as I could get the ideas down, and then she would go in and clean it up. And it was
that's interesting. I guess if you're fantastic. For an instance, like, so if I'm writing something, I generally, and it's going out to somebody that, or something, or for a purpose that I care about, I'll generally write it, and then what I end up with is completely different from what I wrote before. Yeah. So if I have somebody, you know, editing the sentences as I'm typing, I might be thinking, well, I'm not done with that yet. Yeah.
But that live cursor and that live sharing is the killer feature of DOMS for me.
Well, yeah. that's the point you touched upon, and for me too, like, I don't use Docs heavily. I'm not, when I used Word, I didn't use it for some, the intricate features that it has, although it has all those. I use it to write a simple document and share it, right? And I can write a simple document in Docs and share it.
Yeah. It drives me crazy to see, Shannon works for P&G, and there's a lot of Microsoft Word, basically they use Office for everything. And it drives me crazy to see their workflow for sharing documents and managing them. It's just like, they're like, document name _v6_final, and they're emailing this around, and then there's emails like, do you have the latest version of the document? And no, you need to be working on this version of the document, and then they email.
Right, they need source control.
Right, and so it's like, there's like, I have so many great solutions for this, but they just don't. Like, they don't, these are,
Yeah, and there's tons of great
managers,
for this.
Right?
There's,
they don't know what Git is. They don't know what source control is.
Well, beyond that, I mean, Microsoft has SharePoint that has some of this functionality in it that you can do that. But Google Docs is that SharePoint functionality and the document functionality, and no software to install, and you can access it from any device.
Right.
Right. Whereas a Word document, not necessarily.
But a small marketing team inside, even inside a big company, isn't necessarily going to be able to set up its own SharePoint site. Whatever.
If I'm starting a small company, I would. Well, I mean, it's
sure.
It's a little biased because I work for Google, but I would use Google Docs. I mean, there's no.
There's no reason not to.
For me, I set up Docs. I set up email.
I'll disclose. We use Google Docs. We use Google's app stuff for extrovertedeveloper.com as well as a couple other domains that I have. I've got Google accounts. It makes it troublesome when I'm trying to go to Plus, and my domain account can't use Plus, but otherwise it's great. I use it all the time. All right, I don't have anything else today.
That's it for me, too.
All right, thanks for listening.
I feel bad. Well, Toby, I listened to Toby's podcast. There's so many jokes in there, and this one wasn't funny at all.
But this one was much
more. To be fair, Toby is a comedian.
Do you have any jokes?
F of X and constant function go walking down. No. We'll put that in the blooper.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's great to talk to you guys.
Thank you so much for coming on. Thanks, Santos. I know that you were reluctant.